legends were born surrounding mysterious lights seen in the sky flashing. I just lit the back, but then to
and we are back. You know, the only reason I keep coming in here every week to do this show is to hear that music on the half-hour break, and when Darren forgets to play it, I really feel sad. We're going to go back to the phones with my guest, Dr. Bruce Maccabee, and we have some folks right now waiting on the line, and after we get these calls out of the way, I've got some more questions for Dr. Maccabee. Okay, we're going to go to Kathy in Ventura. Good evening, Kathy.
Hey, Don, how you doing?
Well, I'm fine. How about yourself?
Oh, real good. Hey, I hear you're coming up our way soon.
Ah, that's what I understand around the 27th.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I can't wait to see you. My question for Dr. Maccabee is, he was speaking earlier regarding the Star Wars defense.
Yes.
Ray gun. And I'm holding in my hand at the present time a document regarding the Moriches Bay retrieval of an actual saucer that was shot down using Star Wars defense.
Back in New York?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Is he familiar with that?
Bruce?
I'm not familiar.
It was
I'm not
September
sure
28, 1989.
It was shot down in New York.
Yeah, this is a case.
Long Island
this
case?
Is a, right. This is a case that's been bouncing around for a couple of years out of the Long
couple
Island.
Couple of years or recently?
Oh, the last the couple of
John
years.
It was 1989.
1989?
Yes.
I'm not familiar. I'm not familiar with the case, and I would be anybody who claims that it was shot down by Star Wars technology, I would guess, talking through his hat. The only thing that I know of that would remotely have a chance of shooting down anything is out in the White Sands testing area in White Sands, New Mexico, and surrounded by mountains. There's no way that it could reach anywhere near as far as New York.
Well, apparently this device that was used, it was designed to specifically upset the electromagnetic field generated by the UFOs as they're flying. And there were a lot of witnesses involved in this. If you'd like, I could send you a copy of this document I have. Very interesting.
Well, I'd be happy to look at it. I don't know what it may be. There are certainly a lot of loose thinkers out there who try to come up with explain one bizarre thing with another bizarre thing. We don't know that there are guaranteed magnetic fields around UFOs, although certainly there have been some UFO cases that have involved magnetic phenomena, but in any event, even if they did, I have no evidence that we could have anything that would disturb the magnetic field of a UFO.
Well, according to all the witnesses involved, and there were many, this did happen. There were a lot of government and civilian people involved in this, and there are still some people that are scared out of their britches by the government if they talk about this. So
who
apparently
the
something
of the
really
paper?
Big did happen there.
Who wrote that paper, Kathy?
I'm not sure. It was it was processed by the Long Island MUFON people. They did an extensive investigation for almost a year.
Well, if the case is as good as you're talking about, one would think that it would have made it out of Long Island and maybe even into the MUFON Journal. I don't know. Are you familiar with this, Don?
Yes. Yes, I've heard some information on that case. Well, I'll tell you what, Kathy, if you would like to send a copy of that to me, I can forward it to Dr. Maccabee.
Sure, I can do that. That's not a problem.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your call, and keep listening.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. We're going to go to Vince in Tucson. Good evening, Vince.
How are you doing, Don?
I'm very good. How about yourself?
Good. Great show. I have a question for Dr. Maccabee.
Yes.
There's two questions. I'll make them real quick here. Is he aware of the any information on Navy F-14 aircraft that supposedly were taken by UFOs off of Puerto Rico, and I believe it's December of 88? And if he
got
to see any
case
of those photos or do any analysis with it.
Yeah,
and
case,
the other question was
reported on by
the Belgian UFO.
Hold it, guys. One at a time here. Go ahead, Vince.
And the other one is on the Belgian UFO incident. I believe it happened in 88 also.
Okay.
Well, the case, the sightings in Puerto Rico, there have been a number of reports on them. As a matter of fact, you referred to the Ufologist magazine earlier, Don.
Yes.
And your namesakes have done an extensive report on Jorge's stories from Puerto Rico, which you should be aware of if you aren't. Jorge Martin also talked at the MUFON Symposium in Richmond about a number of things that have happened down in New Orleans, down in Puerto Rico, one of which is the event that you're talking about, where a man who remains anonymous and doesn't wish to be known, apparently doesn't even wish to be investigated very well. Jorge thinks that the guy may have been abducted, but in any event, it seems like after the abduction, he saw some jets flying towards a UFO and managed to take some pictures of it. Analysis of the picture showed that although the UFO object, which is quite clear, a very clear image, and the Navy jets are also quite clear, UFO always seems to appear under the same point in a tree branch that's hanging over the picture. And that looks kind of suspicious when you consider all the motion of the jet. The fact that the picture seems to be taken from several different pictures are taken from several different locations next to this tree. In any event, I think that case is still up for grabs. Nobody's pinned it down one way or another, and since the witness appears to be reluctant to allow a more in-depth investigation, I don't know how far or where it's going to go. Independent of that case, though, there have been a number of events down in Puerto Rico, some of which have been witnessed by tens or hundreds of people, I guess.
It's been a veritable hotbed down there.
Yes, all over the island. Now, the other thing you mentioned was Dulce, New Mexico, which the only reason for bringing that up, I presume, is, or at least bringing it up in this day and age, would be as a result of John Lear and some other people circulating information about a so-called battle, I guess, that took place under the Archuleta Mesa, which I guess is north of Dulce, New Mexico.
Which that information originally came from Paul Benowitz.
That's right. And it originally came from an abductee that Benowitz was working with, or at least he thought she was an abductee, via Benowitz. Now, I don't know who that a lady is that he was working with. Somebody may know. But apparently it's something that she had claimed, and he believed, and went searching for it, never found anything. Lots of other people have searched the Archuleta Mesa, I guess, up, down, and sideways, haven't found anything. So I don't have any information other than what's in the stories, which I find highly questionable.
All right, did that answer your question, Vince?
Yes, except the second one had to do with the Belgian UFO.
I thought you said Dulce. Did you say Belgium?
Yes, Belgium.
Oh, I thought you said Dulce, New Mexico. Okay, Belgium. That's a completely different a switch of scene, about as far away as you can get from New Mexico. And I presume you're talking about the sightings that began in 1989 and continued into 1990, and the most famous one being the night that a triangular-shaped object was flying around, and the local Belgian UFO group called SOBEPS, I don't forget what that stands for, SOBEPS, was connected up with the Belgian Air Force, and they were vectoring Belgian jets, Air Force jets, after these objects that were being reported by the civilians. I don't know anything about that hasn't been reported in the open literature. There is a book out in French about the Belgian sighting. That involved not only a photograph, which has been presented on Unsolved Mysteries, but also the radar and the jet that was flying. One of the jets that was flying around had some strange radar echo showing an object that was able to accelerate at high rates of speed. Not really much that I can say about the Belgian cases other than what has already been published. The MUFON Journal had a story on it, translation from the newspaper Paris Match, 2 years ago, I guess it was, or 3 years ago.
We ran some news on it also in UFO Magazine.
Yeah, I would think so. Now, one thing that many people or most people don't know is in parallel with the Belgian flap, there was also a Russian flap. And many people heard about the so-called Voronezh landing in October of 1989, because that was picked up by the general news media and transmitted the New York Times, the Washington Post, virtually every other major...
Right, those were a series of sightings that happened in September of 89.
Yeah, picked up the TASS news story about the Voronezh landing. Maybe it was September, I think it was early October, though. At any rate, that was one of a whole series, which began in, like, May or June of 1989. There were sightings more or less continually at a low rate. And then in November of 89, it picked up. And in March of 1990, about the same time that the Belgian sightings were getting hot and heavy, an event happened near Moscow, which involved, I don't know, maybe 100 Soviet military people, as well as a jet pilot who flew over this and a radar station that was tracking this, an object that was flying around. It was such a spectacular series of sightings that a top Russian general, Air Force general, who was in charge of the Air Defense Command around Moscow, collected together the reports and wrote an article that appeared in a number of Soviet papers. This would be General Malchev, who said that he had testimony from 100 Russian military people. He put in the paper three of the Russian military ground observers, plus the report of the pilot, plus the report of the radar station. It was only a couple of months after that that a newspaper reported that Gorbachev had told some workers in the Ural Mountains that something to the effect that UFOs are real and should be investigated. 6 months later, in November of 1990, a Soviet magazine published a story, an interview with the top Soviet Air Force general, who was in charge of all the air defense forces of the Soviet Union. And they asked him about the sightings around Moscow in March of 1990, and he confirmed that the report by General Malchev was all true. So this is an evidence of the Russians taking a much more liberal attitude towards the Russian military discussing the subject of UFOs than we've ever seen here in the United States.
Absolutely, and that brings me right back to where I want to be, Bruce. Vince, thank you.
Talk about a straight man.
Thank you very much for your call. Please, keep listening.
Okay, thanks, Don.
All right. Okay, that brings us back to exactly where I wanted to get to. One of the allegations that had been in this letter concerned, and you touched on this briefly earlier, the fact that someone indicated that CIA may have as many as 15,000 documents on UFOs that they have in their secret files. Now, from the conversations you and I had earlier, and from the information that that you've talked about, and some of the information that's in this AIR letter, the question is: back in the late 70s, when Zeckel was part of a lawsuit against CIA, which ultimately forced them to release what was it, about 900 documents?
900 pages.
Right, 900. I'm sorry, 900 pages of information. Just about this same time area is when you had a chance to meet with someone in CIA who had many, many documents that mentioned this 15,000 page number. Now, the question is this, Bruce. How many documents were you aware of that the CIA may have had that they were able to circumvent the court order to get them to release? In other words, they were ordered by the...
First of all, I'm not aware of any documents that the CIA has that were not released. You have to understand that the context of that discussion has been somewhat distorted by Mr. Zeckel. Distorted in his favor, of course.
Well, in other words, from what you're saying, you are not sure if they, in fact, have more documents that they did not release?
I don't know whether they did or they didn't.
What's your speculation?
The thing is that the guy that I was talking to didn't know whether they did or they didn't. You have to understand.
Well, he had knowledge of more than 900 pages, didn't he?
No, he had knowledge of the ones that were in his file, which he said might be, he just hadn't counted them, I guess, might be 1,000 pages or so. But I had asked him how many pages, I don't remember the discussion exactly, but evidently I'd asked him something about the possibility that there were more documents and that he wasn't aware of. And I guess that he must have made up a number. There could be thousands more documents. There could be, and he probably pulled a number out of the hat, might be 15,000 more documents or pages of stuff. The point is that an agency like the CIA or any defense agency or intelligence agency like that, they have what's known as compartmented investigation. That's like, it's not necessarily physically like a room, but it's almost like that. So they use the term compartment.
Right.
All the information related to a particular subject that a person needs to know will be in a compartment. Now, that doesn't mean that all the information that the agency knows is in that compartment. There might be somebody else.
Oh, this stuff could be spread out all over, sure. But in your best guess, do you think that they intentionally circumnavigated this court order and, in fact, have more documents than what they've released? Would you speculate that they do or they don't?
Let's put it like this. I wouldn't be surprised if they did.
Okay.
I have no evidence of it.
Okay.
I wouldn't put it past them.
That's
I have no evidence.
That's
of
fair,
it.
Bruce. We've got some people that have been hanging on the phone here. Let's go back to the telephones. We've got Bert in Burbank.
Hello, folks there. Boy, I'm disappointed to hear that Belgium's nowhere near Belgium. I was going to drive to Belgium for vacation. I heard that there were a lot of sightings there. I guess that's out. Could it be Kristen Stilton is who you were talking about with the Binowitz case? Don't recognize that.
I think
that.
Maybe you're right. I'm not positive on that.
Let me ask you a couple of questions.
If that's correct, then he would have been working with her back in around 1979, 1980.
Can't tell you about the date.
This information.
Yeah, I can't tell you about the date of that, but I know at one time they did. That may be much earlier than she got involved with it. Let me ask you a couple of questions. One about the Star Wars technology that you know about, especially laser technology, and this will rival to strike a match here. As far as you know, the power of the even any kind of beam weapons that we have, would it have the power to send a beam of whatever into space that could have been picked up by the video of the space shuttle? No doubt you've seen that videotape as a matter of fact, Don's done some extensive looking into that.
Yeah, well, first of all, even if there had been a beam going up, you wouldn't have seen it. I mean, in the video, in that shuttle video, you actually see things moving around, and some people have said that the vertical straight line streaks coming up, apparently upwards from the Earth, are laser beams. But that makes no sense at all.
No, but could it be ionized gas, Bruce? Hmm? Could it be ionized gas from a laser shot?
I don't think so. Certainly the laser people wouldn't want it to be, because if you ionize the gas in the laser beam, then you use up all your power in the laser in ionizing the gas, and it doesn't get to the target. But those things actually appear as streaks moving along, whereas a laser beam would be traveling at the speed of light. It would go so fast, it would just suddenly appear. You wouldn't see the beam moving.
What about something like railgun technology? Are you very familiar with that?
Yeah, I'm not aware of anybody who's got a railgun that can shoot upwards to
mm-hmm.
speak of. There have been a lot of tests in laboratories that over short distances. The Army may be working on some railgun stuff for tactical use. Certainly it was part of Star Wars, but they were talking about Star Wars people were talking about using railguns in satellites, from satellites in space, so that
right.
the object shot out of the railgun would not have to fight the atmosphere. If you zap something out of a railgun, just like shooting it out of a regular gun, it has to fight its way through the atmosphere, and at the speeds that they were talking about launching things with railguns, you could virtually burn up something that's going through the atmosphere.
Did you examine that video to any extent
Well, I looked at it a number of times. I didn't try to do all sorts of geometrical calculations.
As Hoagland did.
As Hoagland did, right. But like I said, even if he can make an argument that the one particle which seems to turn and go in another direction, even if he can make an argument, which I'm not sure he can, but even if he can make an argument that that was a long distance away from the spacecraft and therefore big, it still is, in my way of thinking, illogical to argue that the streaks that come upwards are rays of either lasers or anything else.
I personally thought, Bruce, that they might be missiles. Bert, we're going to move along. Did that answer your question?
It did. Where are you going to be on the 27th? Kathy always has something interesting to say. Tell us where you're going to be on the 27th so we can come see you.
We were invited to give a talk before the Ventura MUFON folks.
Ah, well, I'll have to somehow get in touch with them and find out about it.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, guys.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bruce. Bye-bye. Okay, we're going to go to Bill in Grand Prairie, Texas on satellite. Good evening, Bill.
Hi, Don. Hi, Dr. McAfee. Hi. My question, Bruce kind of, Bert kind of stole my question there. I was wanting to talk about STS-48, but I was curious. You said you analyzed the Billy Meyer photos.
I said I analyzed a section of film which shows this thing swinging left and right.
Did you come to any final conclusions, whether it was hoaxed or?
Well, I concluded that it could have been.
That it could have been?
It obeyed the laws of a pendulum very nicely. And I wrote an article that was published by the Center for UFO Studies. I think that was published in 1987, called The Pendulum from the Pleiades. So if you have any back issues of that, you could look through it. My guess is that you could have duplicated what appeared on that film with some sort of a not too heavy disc-shaped object on the end of a 12 or 13-foot piece of string that you were pulling off to the side to get it started, and then sort of controlling the way it oscillated with a string from the side or from being up above it. In the article, I pointed out that I couldn't say that Billy Meyer never had any experiences, but there's so many problems with the photos and stuff that he's presented that I never use it as evidence for UFOs.
Yeah, well, I was just kind of curious. There's so many different opinions on it. Thank you.
Okay, Bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
All right, we're going to take our half-hour break, and when we come back, more with my guest, Dr. Bruce McAfee, naval optical physicist. And if you would like to talk to Dr. McAfee or myself, and you're in the 818-213 or 310 area codes, you can. And we'll be back after this.
CRN, the cable radio network, presents this program for its entertainment value only as a service to our listeners.
Legends were born surrounding mysterious lights seen in the sky flashing.
And we are back. Okay, Bruce, I have a question I've been wanting to talk to you about for some time, and it is concerned with the STS-48 video. Whenever you're out here in California on business, you usually give Vicki and I a call at the magazine to get together just to say hello. And a little over a year ago, when you were out here on business, and you called us up, the night that you were visiting is the evening that I received a copy of the STS-48 video. Do you recall that?
Well, I certainly didn't know. Maybe you said. I don't recall. It.
Well, you were sitting in the living room there.
Yeah, I don't recall. It was the night that you got a copy of it.
Right, right. You remember Eric Beckyard had come up with that video.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As we watched that video, and the video itself is a rather amazing thing, you sat there and you didn't make any remarks or didn't comment on it at all, as I recall. It was later that I found out that immediately after this thing was downlinked during a NASA transmission, that a number of people met with some folks, I guess, from the fund, you being one of them. Vince DiPietro came in with that tape. We're talking about right after this mission, which would have been either October or November of 1991, right after the September 91 mission. And it's my understanding that a number of people there were pretty excited about this, but yet you never mention anything about that. What exactly is your take on the STS-48 video, and what do you think it actually shows, and how many people in that meeting back in October or November of 1991 felt that this was a very significant piece of UFO evidence?
Well, I think DiPietro had analyzed it. I guess I would presume that Don Ratch had called it to our attention. You say it was right after
the mission. It was
right
roughly
after the mission. It must have been that Don Ratch was watching it closely and started sending it to people or something. I don't recall all the details of that because I haven't paid extreme amount of attention to it. I certainly did get closely involved with the discovery of a couple of years before, which involved these tape recorded statements that were coming across the communication channel. You may remember in Discovery.
Yeah, with Baja.
The statement that we have the alien spacecraft under observance, or words to that effect.
Bob Bexler was giving that a lot of play.
Yeah, the fund contacted an organization in New Jersey to see if we could get a voice analysis to determine whose voice it was, or if there was an identifiable
right
voice that had made the statement.
But that's a different case.
That's
what
a different case, and
I'm concerned about is the STS thing.
The
now.
The STS-48 one.
Did you see my appearance on Larry King Live?
No.
Okay.
As I recall,
Wait a minute, Bruce. There were only two phone calls that came in during that segment where I was on with Jim Oberg of NASA out of Houston, and one of the two callers was Vince DiPietro.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they were both NASA employees, which I found rather remarkable anyway. But be that as it may, DiPietro tried to diss that particular video and had changed positions on it, claiming that he talked to a number of other scientific personnel and they were thinking it was frozen urine from a water dump. When the fact of the matter is, and I'm working on it right now in a white paper, DiPietro was scared to death for his life and his job because he got involved in this, which would seem to indicate one of two things to me. Number one, either DiPietro is a hysteric, or number two, STS-48 seemed to show something that somebody didn't want involved, and DiPietro, who was associated with it, suddenly thought that he himself might be in some type of danger.
Yeah, well, I'm not familiar with that.
I am.
DiPietro gave us a quote briefing, unquote, on his initial analysis, and he was more interested in, as I recall, a rather large-sized blob thing that appeared in the upper left-hand corner of the video for a short period of time than he was in the streaky things. But I don't know, I may have some other, there have been some other videos that have come down too, and I may have some of those confused.
Well, how many people from the fund were involved with this? Initially seeing this for the first time?
Oh. Could be that he told us all about it. I don't remember. We didn't really do anything about it. I mean, we didn't support any research in it. I think he was primarily analyzing it sort of because Ratchet brought it up, and it did look kind of strange at first.
Well, DiPietro was initially very excited about this.
Yeah, I don't know how excited he was because he was very. Let's say he was at the best. He was certainly circumspect in his excitement. I think he was particularly interested in a portion that was not the the part where you've got the particle changing its direction.
The one that
another,
he digitally
another place
enhanced.
Where there was a rather large-sized blob, as I recall, seemingly silhouetted against clouds. I think that's from the same video, but not at the same place.
Yeah, it was a different. It was a different incident.
Yeah. But like I said, I wasn't tracking that on a day-to-day basis. I know that Rat sent it to a bunch of people. Next thing I knew, Hoagland was making a strong argument that it was some object that was being shot at by, I don't know if Hoagland was the first person to argue this, but certainly it took it up quickly, that Star Wars devices were shooting at spacecraft.
Well, Dr. Mark Carlotto did some analysis on that particular video, and they came up with some rather amazing figures as far as speed and distance from the spacecraft. All right, let's go to the phone lines. We've got somebody that's been hanging on the phone here for quite a while. Wesley in Glendale on Salmon Cable. Good evening, Wes.
Hello?
Yes, do you have a question for my guest?
Something just happened to the phone connection, that's all.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, I used to live in New York, and I recently moved out here and enjoy your show.
Oh, thank
and, you. And I was curious, I used to live up in the Brewster area, and I was wondering whatever happened to the UFOs sightings in that area, you know, the town went nuts, and I didn't see one. My mother happened to see one night. But, I mean, there was meetings at the high school and all these.
Are you talking about the Hudson Valley area of New York?
Yeah. The Brewster Carmel area.
1983 to 85.
Yeah, mid-80s, yeah.
Yeah, that, there's a book that was published 5 or 6 years ago called Night Siege, S-E-I-G-E. Night Siege by...
Heineken, Brogno, and Bob Pratt.
Yeah, right. And... It may be, certainly available, I would think, from some of the UFO booksellers. It's quite a good book, I would say. Have you read it, Don?
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, there were literally thousands of witnesses on some of those nights. One that sticks in my mind was the night that the object came right down the Taconic River Parkway. And for those of you who have never been there, that's running along not too far from the Hudson River. It runs northward from New York City alongside a chain, a mountain chain. Now, mountains in Westchester County are maybe 1,000 feet high, considerably lower than what you're used to on the West Coast. But nevertheless, it does divide the territory into little sections. People tend to live in the valleys between the mountains. And this Taconic River Parkway runs... not perfectly straight, you know, a crooked path northward. And apparently this thing was coming right down the highway about the time, I don't know, 8 or 9 at night, about the time people were going home. And that was just one event out of, I don't know how many, maybe 100 or so.
There was hundreds. The town just went nuts. Everybody was out, you know, looking for them. I also have another question about the recent sighting, of a crop circle upstate New York, which CNN had on this weekend, and said that it was it looks very similar to the ones in Europe and England, and that those were hoaxes, or proved to be hoaxes. Yeah,
What was proved?
The crop circles in England?
No, that's not true.
Well,
more garbage reporting by the news media. Last fall, wasn't it last fall that Doug and Dave did their thing?
No, a little before that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I just saw it yesterday on the news, on CNN.
Yeah, I didn't know that there had been a circle found, though.
I just heard about one that was found in the state of Washington also.
This is upstate New York.
Uh-huh.
Well, they've been getting them now in England, apparently numbering in the many tens. It took a long time for them to start in England, and we haven't heard anything about them because the press isn't picking up the story at all. But
it's kind of like
the
UFO sightings.
Is over there right now checking up on it. Unfortunately, there's no group of people like the Project Argus people over there this year. I don't know if you're familiar with Project Argus.
No.
That was a group of scientifically oriented people who last year took samples and did all sorts of tests on the circles. Unfortunately, the Doug and Dave show put a big wet blanket over the whole thing. So
Yeah.
On the other hand, maybe that's not so bad. Maybe it'll damp down a lot of the interest in there.
Well, you know, there's never been a definitive...
have a better chance of getting at the circle.
There's never been a definitive connection between the circles and UFOs anyway. Wes, I want to thank you for your call. Please, keep listening.
Thank you.
Okay, Bruce, something I want to ask you here. In this AIR document, and we're getting down to about the last 15 minutes of the show, and there's still a couple of areas that that I want to cover. Number one, and let's get this out right now, and I would like you to make a definitive statement. One of the things that have been suggested with your contact with people within CIA, and one of the things that invariably probably will get brought up, is the fact that you are a disinformation person. Is it not true that you have never received any information or disinformation from them for dissemination?
Is it not true?
That's what I'm saying. Is it not untrue that you...
The straightforward statement is I have not received any information from them for information or disinformation. I have not received any information from them, period.
Okay, I wanted to get you on the record with that statement. And the second thing is, now one of the things that you had told me that they did have an interest in when you were over there lecturing or giving a talk or a speech, you had indicated a couple of people were interested in certain personalities in the field and in the computer bulletin networks, computer bulletin boards. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, they had... somebody, one guy over there, I guess, who was interested in the subject, had checked bulletin boards, and he came upon the stuff that was dumped on there by Lear and Cooper and all those other people. What was that, 1988?
88, 89.
Yeah.
Now, was this official, or was this just his own interest?
As far as I could tell, it was just his own interest.
In other words,
I don't know what the hell they do there, whether, I can't say that it absolutely was not official, but I've been led to believe, at least, this was just a question of the guy being interested in the subject, and checking on bulletin boards to see if there's anything on UFOs, and coming up on this Lear and Cooper stuff on CompuServe. I don't know where else it might have been, but I know it was on CompuServe, because I checked in on some of it myself. There's also an O.H. Krill who put some stuff on.
Well, that was a phony document that originally came from Lear and another guy by the name of John Grace, or Val Valerian, as he goes by sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway...
the Krill document.
Yeah, this... I guess the guy who checked up on that stuff, coming not too long after the MJ-12 revelations and so on, didn't know what to make of it. So they would ask me, you know, what was my opinion of this stuff that they were finding on the computer network, and I told them I didn't have a very high opinion of it.
Which I would think probably most legitimate researchers would not.
Yeah, well, I think, Lear, certainly Cooper, started off with some relative level of credibility, but very quickly went down the drain. Lear seemed to try to follow him, maybe pull himself back just at the brink. I don't know if Cooper's even still active in the business, but he was running around, I understand, giving lectures for $1,500 a shot several years ago.
Okay, let's stay in the same church but go to a different pew for a moment. You've known Bill Moore for a number of years.
Yep.
William Moore, who, of course, is co-author with Charlie Berlitz in the Roswell incident. Bill Moore, who in 1987 released the now famous or even infamous MJ-12 documents. Now, in 1988, Bruce, Bill Moore, along with Jamie Chandra, were involved with a television production that now has had an infamy of its own of some type called UFO Cover-Up Live, which many people in active UFO research consider to be, unfortunately, a real travesty, what started out to be a very promising production. But in Moore's segment, they introduced a couple of people who were electronically blacked out, whom Bill Moore and the TV production people identified as Moore's intelligence contacts, Falcon and Condor, two code names for any of you people that may not be quite sure what I'm talking about. And today in the UFO research community, Moore's aviary, or listing of people who allegedly either have or have had high-level intelligence contacts in the UFO research arena, and there are various code names like Falcon, Condor, Pelican, whom is almost, I think, among most knowledgeable researchers, realize they're talking about Pandolfi at CIA. And Zeckel indicated that you were Seagull in Bill Moore's aviary, that you had the code name Seagull. Now, I asked you about that last week, and you were very ambivalent about whether you were Seagull or not. You were not sure. Have you had a chance to give that some further consideration? And do you know if, in fact, Moore identified you as codename Seagull?
Well, I don't know for sure. I've been trying to get a hold of him for last week, and I haven't succeeded. I don't know.
Well, Zeckel,
his number or something.
One of the things, well, yeah, his number is disconnected. I tried to reach him myself. Todd Zeckel, one of the authors of this AIR document, had mentioned when Moore had found out that a British researcher by the name of Armin Victorian was doing,
AKA Dr. Henry
Azzedal, yeah, was doing an investigation on his aviary and was attempting to track down a number of these different folks to find out if they were legitimate or not, had sent out a memo around to various people that allegedly were part of Moore's aviary. And Zeckel had indicated that one of the memos was sent to you. Now, you can either confirm or deny this. But in the memo, and I'm paraphrasing... Bill Moore.
Memo from Bill Moore.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to paraphrase because I have not seen a copy of this, but I just know generally what was said in there. But Moore had stated, according to Todd Zeckel, that Armin Victorian, a.k.a. Henry Azzedal, was investigating the aviary, and most people in the aviary should not be too concerned about it. And Moore allegedly had said in this memo that they were not worried about being discovered. Now, Zeckel claims that you said that you had received a copy of this, and you, in fact, were concerned about being identified with the aviary, which would indicate, if that's true, that you were considered a part of Bill Moore's aviary with a code name, be it Seagull or something else. Do you recall that, and do you have any, do you wish to confirm or deny that?
Well, I remember the memo, which said that Bill said in the memo, it looked to me like it was an open letter to a bunch of people. In response to Azzedal's claim that he was going to reveal the aviary. The memo said, in effect, I've checked with the aviary, and they're not afraid or whatever. I don't forget the exact wording. They weren't worried. He didn't, and I knew he hadn't checked with me.
Well, then that would seem to indicate that you were at least considered some part of the aviary.
No, it seemed to me it would be the opposite. I mean, he was sending out an open letter to everybody that he had checked with the aviary. And I got this thing out of the blue, as it were. He hadn't checked with me beforehand to ask me if I was shaking in my boots.
Ah.
So if the memo said he had checked with the aviary, but he hadn't called me up, I'd have to assume I wasn't part of the aviary.
Do you give any credence to the aviary, Bruce?
Well, I know he's been talking about these people for a long time. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if there is an aviary with all sorts of people trying to get in and become bird names. So far as I know, there were a couple of sources that Bill's been talking about for a long time, which had bird name codes, and I don't know who they are. He never told me.
You've never met any of these people?
The real inner people. Now, I know that a guy by the name of Collins, who I have met a number of times, and Doty, who I met once, it's been claimed that they were Falcon and Condor.
Well, Moore denies that Doty is Falcon or Condor.
Yeah, if that's true, I mean, if Bill is telling the truth, then I would presume that Doty and Condor may have been Doty and Collins may have been stand-ins for the real Falcon and Condor, but I don't know who the real Falcon and Condor are. So, on that one.
Were you present, Bruce, at the 1989 MUFON Symposium in Las Vegas?
No.
You of course are aware of Moore's 2-hour presentation that he gave there, admitting that he had been a conduit for information from Air Force OSI back to them on various people in the field, including Paul Benowitz.
Yep. I read the paper that he published. I don't know what he said there specifically, but I know I read the paper. It's in the MUFON Symposium.
Right. How do you feel about that? Do you think that that was morally correct or morally inexcusable? I mean, what we're talking about now is basically, I guess the best way to phrase it would be somebody that is informing on his colleagues and associates in the field.
Well, I don't think it would be a good thing to be doing. I don't know what the conditions were at the time that Bill had sort of made this decision. He seemed to make an argument at the symposium. A lot of people didn't buy. Sometimes it's hard to second guess. You know, our hindsight is 100% perfect. In any event, I don't think it would be advisable to be an informer.
Do you see this field getting any better? I mean, in the last 5 years, Bruce, it probably even more so than years past, it seems to have been imploding in upon itself. For the most part, many researchers have ceased doing good research, and they've become advocates for their particular cases. The subject is still sneered at in many corners. The mainline scientific establishment still holds its nose up when somebody mentions unidentified flying objects. Do you see this improving any? Do you think that there is a hope for additional decent research to be done? Do you think that the phenomenon has any possibility of being cracked?
Well, I suppose if you've got another whole show, we could answer that question.
Well, give me the two-minute version.
Yeah, the two-minute version. I would say that since the UFOs themselves have been running the show ever since the beginning, if there hadn't been any sightings at all, if they had attempted to maintain total secrecy, then there wouldn't be any UFO investigators and we wouldn't be having this show. So there must be some intent on the part of the phenomenon itself to make people aware of it. Now, if it goes on the way it is, with sightings and maybe abductions and stuff, that could last, it could go on like that, I presume, for years. On the other hand, there's a continual infiltration into society of the subject. You know, I mean, you've no doubt noticed this in terms of increases in listenership and increases in readership of UFO Magazine. MUFON is now up to 4,000 members. About 5 years ago, it really started to pick up by the time of the 1987 symposium here in D.C., that the memberships and organizations started to grow and has continued. Now, this UFO membership is still a small, tiny drop in a huge bucket compared to the rest of the population. Nevertheless, the rest of the population is being alerted or stimulated, and the interest is being stimulated by things like the movies and TV shows that come out, and you know, even things as supposedly mundane as unsolved mysteries and sightings. Have their contingents, probably thousands, tens of thousands of people who watch those shows rather than watch your normal violence and sex that you see on the rest of the shows and TV. So I think sometime there's going to be a critical mass. I don't know when that is, at which point population in general, if not the scientific community by itself, will suddenly realize that there really is something going on here. The scientific community is has had its head stuck in the sand and probably will keep it there until somebody comes along and kicks it in the rear end.
Have you been able to convince anyone that there is a real phenomenon here in the scientific establishment?
Oh, yeah, I've been able to convince a number of people. That's not the same as saying that I get active support or that these people that become convinced are going to go out and do anything on their own.
Superstation.
Oops. Well, I think, Bruce, I think that was the signal.
We're out of time. Thanks very much. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Don Ecker Live.
Yep, that was the notice that we're just about out of time. Bruce, I'd like to thank you for taking a couple of hours out of your very busy schedule. And especially
out of my sleep.
Exactly, especially considering your 3 hours in front of us back on the East Coast. I'd like to have you come back on. Do you think at some point in the future you could find that in your schedule?
I presume.
Well, good. Bruce, hang on.
I'm going to be on Bob Bigelow's show in Las Vegas next week.
Okay. Hang on just a moment on the line here, and I'll be right with you. Okay, folks, that is it for another week. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight. You have been listening to the Cable Radio Network. Tune in again a week from tonight at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight on the East Coast for another edition of UFOs Tonight. Once again, a special thanks and congratulations to our three winners, and they are Edwin Hoffmeister in Rolla, Missouri, Gareth and Karen Davies in Monterey Park, California, and Bill Rawls in Grand Prairie, Texas. You folks will be hearing from me this week. Keep your eyes to the skies, and here's the music.
Baby, take my hand.